With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, reporting from day one at the Citrus and Specialty Crop Expo in Florida. Edward Spang takes over at the Mondavi Institute at UC Davis. The acclaimed Robert Mondavi Institute for Wine and Food Science at the University of California, Davis has a new director. Edward, also known as Ned Spang, took over the position on August 1st. He replaced Andrew Waterhouse, who retired back in June after 5 years as director. Spang joined UC Davis 12 years ago as an associate director for the Center for Water Energy Efficiency. He's been a faculty member with the Department of Food and Science and Technology since 2015. The Mondavi Institute is home to the university's winemaking, brewing, and food science programs. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. Minimum wage to reach $16 by 2024.
We've, in the state of California, we have been experiencing minimum wage increases for the last several years. It was due to legislation that was to get us up to $15 an hour by 2023. And we are now there. And actually, in January, we went beyond $15 an hour and went to $15.50. Employers are now in 2023, you know, working against that. However, we've got another increase that is scheduled for 2024.
What's the reason for the increase in minimum wage? President and CEO of AgSafe, Teresa Keene, tells us more about the 50-cent jump.
So built into that legislation, so once we got to that $15 an hour mark, the legislation had also popped in kind of this inflation increase as well to make sure that minimum wage was keeping up with the rate of inflation. So in the legislation, it says that minimum wage can increase each year up to about 3.5%. And so that has happened. And so we are now looking at 2024. We just heard that it's going to go to $16 an hour, whether or not you are a small employer or a large employer. So it's across the board. $16 an hour is what the going minimum wage will be for 2024. So everybody that's a planner out there and is working on budget, so you can start to figure that into your operations for next year.
Stay tuned as we'll have more on this report in the coming shows. But for right now, here's AgNet West Brian German with more agriculture news.
The California Air Resources Board has announced that applications will be accepted through August 31st for CARB's Funding Agricultural Replacement Measures for Emissions Reductions program known as the Farmer Program. The program will be distributing up to $5.4 million in funding to producers in 15 air districts. Farmer funding is meant to replace older ag vehicles and equipment with newer, cleaner equipment that CARB describes as helping to reduce emissions of harmful diesel exhaust and greenhouse gases and improves local air quality. Funding is administered by California's regional air districts, and farmers must apply by August 31st directly with their local air district. Farmer funding can be used for purchasing off-road equipment replacements such as tractors, agricultural pumps, UTVs, and small tractor replacements. More information regarding eligible air districts and a link to the application portal can be found at agnetwest.com. Combining cultural practices can help reduce the need for miticide applications in orchards. Senior Director of Agronomy for Olam Food Ingredients, Zach Ellis, described how they were able to largely move away from the need for miticides in their almonds.
There's never a silver bullet, but we think a big portion of making sure that we can help with beneficial insects and have them help control some of our detrimental insects is not only developing cover crop, not only having softer chemistry, but also making sure that when we go out, we're very intentional with how we want to solve a problem, right? And when it came to like the two-spotted spider mites, it was both removing abamectin, removing pyrethroids, using road oil or water on the road so it doesn't get dusty, spraying the edges where the mites begin to start with just like a detergent and some water just to kill the webbing and where they're really beginning to start to build their population on top of the cover crop, where now we have six spotted thrips that are in the field that their population builds soon after and begins to control those mites. So overall, by doing some of those cultural things, planting cover crop, and all of the like behind that, we've been able to completely remove most of our miticides out of our program for the year.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
If your soil could talk, what would it say? If it's healthy, it may already be saying some good things about your future. Because farmers who use soil health building systems that include no-till, cover crops, and diverse species and rotations report greater productivity, profitability, and resiliency to weather extremes. Learn more about what your soil is saying about its health and your future. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says there's been a little change to the cotton crop around the nation.
We do see this cotton crop continuing to develop, with 72% of the cotton crop setting bolls by August 13th, 5 points behind the five-year average. And Texas, our number one production state, holding back that national number. In Texas, only 64% setting bolls, five-year average 72%. Moving to cotton bolls opening, August 13th number is 13%, five-year average 14%, last year at this time also 14%. Cotton condition, there is where Texas and the Southern Plains, with their heat wave that has been going on now for 2 months, is dominating the cotton condition numbers. Just 36% of the U.S. cotton rated good to excellent on the 13th of August. That's down 5 percentage points from last week's 41%. Meanwhile, 43% rated very poor to poor. That is up a whopping 9 percentage points from last week.
In other news, U.S. pork exports concluded an excellent first half with another strong performance in June. That, according to data released by USDA and compiled by the U.S. Meat Export Federation. USMEF President and CEO Dan Holstrom notes that while the growth in the pork sales is led by Mexico, several regions are contributing to the strong exports.
For the first 6 months, we're up 14% on volume, up 12% on value. And that the real star of the show continues to be Mexico, up 14% off of last year, by far a record. So that's encouraging. But I would say what's even more encouraging is that it's not just one country. I mean, we've got the Hong Kong, China region up, mainly driven by variety meats. Japan had a good month in June. Demand is solid on the pork side. And there's some outside factors helping that, like the shortage or relatively short situation of pork in Europe, which is making U.S. pork even that much more attractive in markets like Taiwan.
Kelly Wicks, the manager of international market development for the National Pork Board, agrees that focusing on the diversity of the market opportunities for U.S. pork has paid off during the first half of 2023.
We are growing in the Philippines and Malaysia, and we're regaining market share in the rest of Southeast Asia. And that can be largely due to European pork prices increasing and their herd sizes decreasing. And so we're able to position U.S. pork a bit differently in those markets.
Wick said China continues to grow, up to 24% over a year ago in volume and up 20% in value. Holstrom points out those strong export sales are building value for U.S. pork producers.
Year to date, the first half value per head of exports on the pork side was just under $64 a head. That represents 10% growth year on year. And I would say that we're positioned going into the second half of the year to not only maintain, but possibly exceed those numbers globally.
The U.S. Grains Council is hosting a trade team of beer makers from Mexico up in the Northern Plains. Steve Edwardson, administrator of the North Dakota Barley Council, says organizers will showcase the high quality of U.S. barley to the Mexican delegate.
Now that we're kind of getting back to business as usual a little bit more, Barley Council is going to be hosting a craft brewing team from Mexico. The six largest craft brewers in the country are going to be making a swing through the Northern Plains, starting out actually in Washington State, going through Montana, and coming into North Dakota and Minnesota as well. So it'll be nice to host them, see what it is that they're looking for with regard to malt quality. We'll talk to them a little bit about barley procurement and what purchasing and logistics look like. So that's just part of the overall market development.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, we told you last week the U.S. pork exports ended the first half of the year with another strong performance in June. But data released by USDA and compiled by the U.S. Meat Export Federation shows beef exports were well below the record pace of last year. USMEF President and CEO Dan Hallstrom notes that while growth in pork sales is led by Mexico, a number of regions are contributing to the strong exports.
For the first 6 months, we're up 14% on volume, up 12% on value. And that the real star of the show continues to be Mexico, up 14% off of last year, by far a record. So that's encouraging. But I would say what's even more encouraging is that it's not just one country. I mean, we've got the Hong Kong, China region up, mainly driven by variety meats. Japan had a good month in June. Demand is solid on the pork side. And there's some outside factors helping that, like the shortage or relatively short situation of pork in Europe, which is making U.S. pork even that much more attractive in markets like Taiwan.
Now, June pork exports total 245,964 metric tons. That's up 12% from a year ago. Export value climbed 6%. Through the first half of the year, pork exports were 14% above last year's pace. But value is up 12%.
Year to date, the first half value per head of exports on the pork side was just under $64 a head. That's represents 10% growth year on year. And I would say that we're positioned going into the second half of the year to not only maintain, but possibly exceed those numbers globally.
Now, beef exports in June were a little over 115,000 metric ton. That's down 12% from a year ago, slightly below the May 2023 volume. Export value at $909.5 million is down 13% year over year, but it is the highest since October. Now, first half beef exports were 10% below last year's record pace. Value was just under $5 billion. Hallstrom points out that some bright spots emerging in the beef export side.
We had the highest value since the fall of 2022 for a month, so easily the largest value month for this year, led by Mexico. And if you look at Mexico year to date, we're up 14% on the beef side, and that's a combination of variety meats and muscle cuts. We have some other regions continue to show growth as well. Africa having a tremendous first half of the year, led by variety meats, of course, South Africa in particular. You know, the EU is up, and you have places like Peru that are up, led by variety meats. So I would say that on the beef side, you're starting to see some trend lines come through that are more and more positive every day.
Again, that was USMEF's president and CEO, Dan Hallstrom. More of the first half numbers for U.S. pork, beef, and even lamb exports are on the USMEF website, usmef.org. And the American Sheep Industry Association is offering two yearly grant programs to its state member associations, but you must apply by September the 8th. To learn more, go to their website, sheepusa.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drug disposal.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
We spent more of our income on food in 2022. That's coming up on This Line of Ours. U.S. consumers spent an average of 11.3% of their disposable personal income on food in 2022, a level not observed since the 1980s, according to USDA's Economic Research Service. Disposable personal income is the amount of money consumers have left to spend or save after paying taxes. Consumers spent 5.62% of their incomes on food at supermarkets, convenience stores, warehouse club stores, supercenters, and other retailers in 2022, and 5.64% on food at restaurants, fast food establishments, schools, and other places offering food away from home. In 2022, the share spent on total food had the sharpest annual increase of 12.7%. This followed an 8.2% decline during the first year of the coronavirus pandemic in 2020. Which was the sharpest annual drop in total food spending since 1967. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McOwen. The family battle over who gets singer Aretha Franklin's property was recently in the news. It seems Aretha had a formal will prepared and executed in 2010 that left her home to three sons. But after she died, a 2014 handwritten will was found in a notebook in her couch. Only two of her sons got her home under that will. Can a handwritten will be valid? Can Aretha Franklin's handwritten will found in her couch control the disposition of her assets? In many states, there's no restriction against writing your own will if you otherwise meet certain rules such as signing and dating it, having it witnessed, and leaving it in a safe place. Aretha's will may not have ended up in court if it had contained a clause saying that it was revoking her prior 2010 will. Also, it didn't contain a no-contest clause. If it had, the son disputing the 2014 handwritten will may not have challenged it for fear of losing his inheritance in her song royalties. So while you can write your own will, you probably shouldn't. That's particularly true if you have a farm or ranch or other small business or otherwise have substantial assets. As for Aretha's handwritten will, it met all the requirements for a valid handwritten will in Michigan and was deemed valid. But you may not want to keep it in the couch, along with those chips and coins and lost socks. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McOwen.
This time last year, regarding farmland values,
we had this big run-up in our farmland values. They actually shot up a whopping 12.4% in 2022. Cropland values in particular were above 14% year-over-year growth.
Sean Arita of USDA's Office of the Chief Economist explained some of the factors behind that growth.
We had record farm income. Commodity prices were very, very high. Corn and wheat prices in particular, they had shot up following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And at that time, at least during the first part of that year, the Fed really hadn't started raising their interest rates.
So what type of growth in farmland values were then recorded in 2023 per USDA?
The average farmland value is about $4,048 per an acre. This is up from last year, so it's up about 7.4%.
And while lower growth was noted year over year, Arena says the rate of growth in farmland values remained strong.
The 7.4% on top of the 12.4% we had last year, that's still very, very strong. I would describe it as being very resilient to some of those headwinds that were in play.
The breakdown by cropland values and pasture land values look like this.
For the cropland values, this year we are at $5,460 per an acre. So that's a $410 per an acre increase, or 8.1% from the previous year. The pasture side, NAS is reporting $1,760 per an acre. This is a $110 increase, or 6.7% increase from 2022.
Meanwhile, USDA also looked at how cash rents of farmland changed year over year.
The numbers that were just released show that the cash rents are coming in at 5%. That's kind of in line with what we saw last year. Again, still lower than what we saw on the value side, which is above 7% again. So the cash rentals, it's weaker for the third consecutive year as opposed to the value side.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Why do you listen?
I just want to stay informed while I'm on the go.
News on the radio, it's nice because it's just a quick snippet and I don't have to go searching for it or grab a paper.
I listen to radio because anywhere that I'm going, I'm listening to music or I'm listening to a talk show or I'm just trying to stay up on current events.
I always turn into the radio to see if I need to take shelter or where it's hitting, to see what I need to be preparing for.
Why do you listen? Go to whyilisten.com, tell us why you listen, and you have a chance to win $500. Visit whyilisten.com today.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
In Farm and Ranch headlines from Agnet West, it's looking to be a good year for pork exports. More after this. U.S. pork exports end an excellent first half with another strong performance in June. U.S. MEF President and CEO Dan Holstrom notes that while the growth in the pork sales is led by Mexico, several regions are contributing to these strong exports.
It's not just one country. I mean, we've got the Hong Kong-China region up, mainly driven by variety meats. Japan had a good month in June. Demand is solid on the pork side.
Kelly Wicks, the manager of international market development for the National Pork Board, agrees that focusing on the diversity of the market opportunities for U.S. pork has paid off during the first half of 2023.
We are growing in the Philippines and Malaysia, and we're regaining market share in the rest of Southeast Asia. And that can be largely due to European pork prices increasing and their herd sizes decreasing. And so we're able to position U.S. pork a bit differently in those markets.
I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West. Welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook from an award-winning chef in under 3 minutes or less. I'm your host with the most. Let's get untamed. So my recipe today, I definitely, even though the weather's really, really hot, this is great time to pull out the grills and start doing some barbecuing. So what better than some beautiful chicken? I've been eating a lot of chicken lately because you could really tell the test of a chef on how they make chicken. And fortunately, some of the chicken I've had, it's been really, really incredible. So that must mean somebody knows what they're doing. But I want to share my knowledge of chicken with everyone here. This is a very simple recipe that packs lots and lots of flavor. I cannot talk about it enough, so let's get to cooking and let's get untamed. This is my recipe for honey brick chicken. Now, traditional brick chicken, you literally would get a hot brick or a skillet and put it on there, and we're not going to do anything different. We're going to do exactly the same. We're going to be using little mini skillets, though. It's a very simple recipe. All we're going to do is we're going to take 4 boneless chicken thighs. Now, chicken thighs, you could do chicken thighs or you could do the chicken steaks, which usually you could get like at the carniceria, and that's typically the drum and the thigh, and they take all the meat off of that. And as long as the skin's on there, the skin is very important for this recipe. So what I'm going to do first and foremost is I'm going to take my chicken thighs or my chicken steaks. I'm going to make sure that we pat them down dry, and we're going to put them just with a little bit of oil over the top of the skin, and we're going to put them like in a pan or a plate, whatever you have. I like to use a pan on the bottom shelf of your fridge. You're going to let them sit for 4 hours. Now, this is important because what we're trying to do is establish just a little bit more texture to the skin. And the only way to do this is to let them really dry or almost age in a way. But not everybody has an ager at home. But refrigerating would do the exact same thing. Simply, I am going to make a rub. But before I make this rub, I'm going to do my salt and pepper. 2 tablespoons of salt and coarse black pepper. And we're going to put that all over our chicken. Next thing I'm going to do is our rub. And the rub is a very simple recipe. 1 tablespoon each cayenne pepper, dehydrated garlic, dried chive, hot paprika. If you don't have hot paprika, paprika will work. I like a little bit of kick with this and a little bit of cumin as well. And for the liquid part of this, 2 tablespoons of lemon juice. Always fresh, never concentrate, and 1/4 cup of orange juice. And we're going to mix all of this together with our chicken. I like to let this marinate for at least 24 hours because it's going to give us a proper marinated piece of chicken. Now, very simply this, once I take this out of the marinade, this is going to go onto a medium-high skillet, and it is going to be very, very hot because cast iron is going to contract heat a lot faster than any other pan. So it's very, very important that we really make sure this is hot. Once the chicken goes skin side down into our skillet, and remember, we always put a little bit of oil, but there will be oil already in this mixture, so it should be okay. I'm going to take another skillet and put over the top, and I'm going to sear this for a good 5 minutes on a very high heat. This is not only going to give us a beautiful skin, but it's also going to yield something beautiful of the breast. But of the meat of the chicken. Because this is dark meat, it's not going to dry. It's going to be super delicious and amazing. And to finish us off, organic honey right over the top and serve immediately. I'm Albert J. You know me as the Untamed Chef from AgNet West.
While generally in most years in most areas of the country, even at this late date in the summer, the trees are green and lush, not ready for fall just yet. But this year, in many areas, you walk in your yard and you're walking on lots of yellow or brown leaves crunching underfoot.
Seems like every few years, our July and August get so dry that many trees in the landscape, their leaves turn, they'll turn yellow and brown and fall to the ground.
That's Charles Barden. He's an extension forester at Kansas State University. This scenario is being played out in many areas of the country this year because of drought and also a hotter than normal summer. Of course, this sends many homeowners into a bit of a panic, wondering if their trees are actually dying. But according to Barden,
if it's a well-established native type tree species, let's say any of the oaks or hackberry or cottonwood, they can lose a lot of leaves during the summer droughts, and it really does not hurt the tree very much. If it's a newly planted tree, say something not very drought tolerant like a flowering dogwood or a red maple, if it's newly planted, that tree could be dying when you see those brown leaves falling.
Oh, there goes one now. Kind of a heavy leaf, though. And by newly planted, Charles Barden is talking about anything put in the ground within the last couple of years. The problem is, by now, if you're seeing leaves, those brown leaves falling. Yes, there's another one. If those leaves are from mature trees, Charles Barden says at this point, water is not going to help them. They're just going to go into dormancy. They'll be back ready to go next spring if there's water by then. So don't waste your water on those trees right now.
And I would concentrate the watering on your newly established trees or your foundation shrubs, the shrubs near the house.
So far, we've only been talking about trees that normally lose their leaves in the fall. Those can take a lot of drought and lose their leaves, go into dormancy, and be fine next year. But if you have evergreen trees, that's another story. Once you see some color changes in the usually deep green needles and foliage of big evergreen trees,
it's probably too late. In fact, before the cedar or pine tree dies, you'll just notice that's kind of a grayish-green color. It just doesn't look right, almost like an olive or grayish-green color. And then within a week, then those needles just go ahead and turn brown. But once you can see the color change, it's probably too late.
Those trees may not survive. Now, regular slow-soaking waterings earlier in the season might have saved them, but now they may have gone to tree heaven. In Washington, Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
As harvest begins, the American Seed Trade Association reminds farmers to be diligent in taking the proper precautions to ensure treated seed does not enter the domestic or export grain supply. When properly handled, seed treatments are an effective agronomic tool that provides seeds the necessary protection for a strong, healthy start. Completely remove all treated seed left in containers and equipment used to handle harvested grain and dispose of it properly. Always be careful to follow state and federal guidelines for proper handling, storage, and disposal of treated seed. For more information, visit seed-treatment-guide.com or contact your seed dealer.
Welcome back to the show. For today's interview segment, we're talking with AgNet Media Multimedia Journalist Clint Thompson as the Citrus and Specialty Crop Expo kicks off day one here in Florida. This expo is one of AgNet Media's biggest annual events and welcomes more than 1,000 attendees and exhibitors for 2 days of trade shows and seminars. Clint, our listeners in California have yet to hear from you, so why don't you just tell me a little bit about yourself and what you do with AgNet Media?
Okay. I am a multimedia journalist here at AgNet Media. I'm based in Tifton, Georgia, which is about an hour north of Florida. And I've been with AgNet since 2020, so this is my third expo. And kind of what I'm mostly in charge of is our specialty crop and industry website. I deal with fruits, vegetables, tree nuts, mainly South Georgia, Florida, Georgia. Well, Florida, Georgia, and Alabama, and part of the Carolinas. I write for Specialty Crop Industry Magazine. I also do daily radio spots for Southeast Ag for their vegetable and specialty crop news segment.
Very nice. We've got a lot of specialty crop growers in California, so I'm sure they would benefit from listening to some of what you offer your growers here in the Southeast. But we did hear a forklift in the background, and one of the reasons why you and I are here together is because we are working on an expo for our company. So why don't you go ahead and tell us about the expo?
Well, the expo, this is our first year at the Florida State Fairgrounds in Tampa. Like I said, this is my third. The previous years have been always been in Fort Myers, but they've moved it up a couple hours closer to my home, which is nice. It cuts out the commute. But yeah, the expo, it's a yearly event that I think we've had tremendous support from the vendors and sponsors and people who have just actually come to visit. You know, a couple years ago we incorporated the specialty crops part of it. It used to be just citrus, and now when you talk about citrus, you're talking about a lot, because a lot of these growers not only are doing citrus, they're doing vegetables and other fruits. So, you know, it's very worthwhile for them to come and learn about what's happening in the vegetable market, what diseases, what pests they need to be mindful of. You know, white flies is a big insect down here in South Florida that growers have to deal with. So a lot of different things like that. That's kind of what encompasses. And, you know, for it to be a two-day event, you know, you have to have a lot of information for growers to want to come. And I really believe that we've, you know, been able to do that, especially coordinating with the University of Florida, IFAS.
That's right. If you can, just give our producers out in California a taste of what your producers here may be challenged with. Talk to me about some of the challenges of agriculture here in the Southeast.
Well, the biggest challenges, I think, you know, I get a sense talking with growers is that it's either labor or trade. Labor is obviously is a huge issue. Growers are having a tough time trying to get enough of it, and then when they have to go through the H2A process, they're thankful it's there, but it's an expensive, cumbersome, highly regulatory process that, you know, all of them says needs to be improved upon. That's one. Unfair trade with Mexico and other countries, I think, is, you know, a big part on what they would like to see improved on. So labor trade from a production standpoint, you know, like I said, white flies is a huge issue for cucurbit farmers. Diseases, you know, here in South Florida, you get everything from weather standpoint. So natural disasters, I mean, Florida provides an environment that you can grow stuff year-round and grow pretty much anything, but it's also very susceptible to the environment and the elements.
As a multimedia journalist and as someone who's working on the Agnet Media side, what are you most looking forward to covering this event?
I think just to kind of get an idea of what is on the horizon, you know, talking with UF IFAS researchers, getting an idea from them, because a lot of them do, you know, it may not be the same presentations every year, but they're kind of rehashing, it's building on stuff that was brought at the expo in previous years. So get an idea from them, where do we stand with this issue? Is it improving? What needs to be done to give growers hope? Because at this point, that a lot of them, they're clinging to, you know, the research that's being done at UF IFAS to help them be more sustainable in the future.
And if folks, you know, back in California, if they want to tune in to anything that's happening, is there a website that they might, you know, want to visit with information about the Citrus and Specialty Crop Expo and even maybe some of the stuff that you cover?
Sure. I, like I said, I'm in charge of our specialty crop industry website, and we update it every day. There's, like I said, next few days we'll have stuff rehashing how the expo went. And, you know, it's gearing up for a lot of the, here in South Florida, the fall schedule. You know, you have strawberries, won't be too long, tomatoes, a lot of stuff that, like I said, makes Florida unique, being able to grow that kind of crops that other places would not. So, specialty crop industry website, our citrus industry website, obviously encompasses mostly citrus, but citrus is getting big in South Georgia and Alabama as well, so a lot of that is going to be covered in the specialty crop industry as well.
You got it, Clint. Thanks so much. Have a good expo.
All right. Thank you.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news, At a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
How are GMO plants made? First, scientists look for a desired trait in a plant, animal, or even bacteria. It could be a trait like resistance to drought, insects, or viruses. Then they copy the gene that contains that trait and insert it into the DNA of the plant they want to improve. Scientists then grow that plant to see if it adopts the desired trait. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. Camelina as a renewable aviation fuel. Since 2006, Sustainable Oils have been working with Camelina in the renewable fuel space on Camelina breeding with the intent to turn the crop into aviation fuel. Mike Karst, president of Sustainable Oils, says not only is Camelina a good cover crop, but it's also a good source for renewable fuel.
What we want to grow is grow Camelina in between the major crop cycles or on land that is fallow. So in the far west, if we think about Montana is where we do a lot of our fallow production, it's a wheat fallow rotation for many growers. We can take one of those fallow years and put Camelina on there because, one, it's a very short season crop. This year in Montana, it's the first crop coming out of the field. Two, it's a really low water use crop.
Karst says 45,000 U.S. acres are contracted Camelina and about 42,000 are harvested due to weather-related losses. Karst says they are looking for additional contract growers.
We cannot grow enough Camelina to outpace the demand.
Most genetics are being developed in Montana, and a majority of Camelina is grown in Oregon, Washington, and Colorado, with Kansas and Oklahoma becoming bigger Camelina growing states. Karst says they are pleased that the Risk Management Agency now offers insurance available for many states that have Camelina production. An AFB contributed to that report.
Farm shops are integral components of most farming operations, the place to store and maintain essential equipment. Now there's growing interest in shop houses, also known as chouses, says Lisa Bocklage, marketing manager for Morton Buildings.
As farm operations continue to expand, there's been an increased need for a farmer or farm manager to be on site across multiple locations. Shop houses or chouses are a great option for these growing operations. They offer living quarters connected to a large shop with space for equipment storage and maintenance, as well as hobbies and recreational vehicle storage.
Bocklage says when building a shop house, upfront planning is especially important to achieve a structure that is both attractive and highly functional.
First, be sure to consider how much you can realistically fit into the shop area. Make a list of all the vehicles, hobby accessories, and tools you expect to store there during the next 5 to 10 years. Second, many shops are larger and taller than the home. The orientation of the shop, as well as certain design features, can help soften the difference in size and height to provide a more unified look. Third, ensure that windows, walk doors, and overhangs for the shop and house have a consistent style to help provide curb appeal. Also, consider including a bathroom in the shop, especially if it's used for greasy or dusty work. That way, it won't be necessary to go inside the house to wash your hands.
She notes that Morton has experience building shop houses throughout the United States.
Our shop houses utilize the same post-frame construction method as all Morton structures to provide strength and durability. Our shop house offering includes certified structural design, site preparation, an engineered concrete foundation, wall insulation, and the overall building shell, including doors and windows. Finally, the open floor plan enables owners and their contractors to finish the interior living quarters space to fit their needs and design preferences.
For more information, visit MortonBuildings.com. Michael Clements reporting.
Acres USA will be hosting a Healthy Soil Summit in Seaside on August 23rd and 24th. The annual event includes 2 days of workshops, speakers, and tours. The first day of the summit will begin with optional add-on field tours, where participants will be visiting two local farming operations. The program will begin after the field tours and will feature discussions on regenerative agricultural techniques and technologies, biological farming approaches, soil microbiomes, and nutrition. On the second day of the summit, there will be a soil health agronomist panel, as well as a panel on tools and technology to support soil health. There will also be multiple strategic case studies covering the role of biologicals in soil health and managing the water cycle through soil ecology. More information on the summit is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
Tractor sales growth softens in the U.S. and Canada. Self-propelled combine sales continue to increase in the U.S., while total farm tractor unit sales in the U.S. and Canada declined in July. The latest data from the Association of Equipment Manufacturers says overall unit sales of U.S. combines rose almost 11% compared to July of 2022, while tractor sales dropped 5% compared to July of last year. The tractor decline was driven largely by the softness in the smaller horsepower segment. Canadian tractors saw slower sales in July with a decline of almost 20%, with combines dropping 16% year-over-year for the month of July. Senior Vice President with the Association of Equipment Manufacturers, Kurt Blade, says, quote, "We're still seeing moderate growth in the traditional ag market that has shown a steady rise all year in North America. So far this year, tractors are down more than 9% in the U.S., while combines are up 41%. NAFB contributed to that report.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at Agnet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. Agnet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.